I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The author Michael J. McCann joins me now. His latest novel is called The Fregoli Delusion. It's a murder mystery. That's the third in the Donahue and Stainer crime novel series. In this book, Lieutenant Hank Donahue and Detective Karen Stainer have to solve the murder of billionaire H.J. Jarrett, who was shot to death. I'll get Mr. McCann to tell us about the book, the sort of themes discussed, like the psychotic disorder that the book is named after, who Donahue and Stainer are, and more. Michael McCann joins me from his home in Oxford Station, Ontario. He has written three other books, the thriller The Ghost Man, and the two previous books in the series, Blood Passage and Marcy's Murder. The website for more is at mjmccann.com. This book is published by Plaid Raccoon Press. Please welcome to the Plot Online program, Michael McCann. Mr. McCann, good morning.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Very good. Yourself?
Very good.
So in reading up on you, I read with interest that you work for Canada Border Services Agency for, that was your career, I guess, right?
Yeah, it was. Well, it was, the last step in my career, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I was with them for 15 years altogether.
Yeah, and so you've since retired from that, right?
That's right. I took early retirement just before I turned 50.
Yeah. Now, that's a fascinating job in of itself. So you left that, and then you now write full-time, is that correct?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. Have you always been interested in crime stories?
Yes, I have, yeah. Yeah, I've always been interested in genre fiction, right from when I was a little kid. You know, when I was a small boy, I was always a book reader and a daydreamer, and I was the one who was, you know, always staggering home from the library with an armload of juveniles, you know, the science fiction, the sports juveniles, and mm-hmm. historical fiction. And, you know, as I grew up, I added crime fiction and mysteries and that to the repertoire. So, yeah, I've always been very interested in them.
So when did you think or figure out that, because I like to read this stuff, maybe I'd like to write it myself?
Yeah.
How long ago was that? That you decided that you could write in this genre that you like reading in?
Well, it wasn't until actually after I retired, because when I retired, my intention was to start writing fiction full-time. And the first novel that I wrote actually was supernatural fiction, as you mentioned, The Ghost Man. I wrote a ghost story because at that time my son was at an age where he was interested in that kind of stuff. And while I was writing that novel, one of the minor characters was a police inspector. And I enjoyed working with that character in the ghost story so much that I decided, okay, I'm just going to switch right into crime fiction and I'm going to start a series and just keep on going with that.
Yeah. Now, but we'll talk about the series in just a sec. In terms of your job with Border Services, did that, I guess you can't do something for 15 years and it not influence, say, your writing.
Oh, that's quite true. I started actually at our training college in Quebec. I was hired there as a support clerk. So I did typing and filing and, you know, I helped get the lesson plan material ready for the customs recruits and that kind of thing. And I had plenty of time to, you know, look at what I was working with and read it and start absorbing it. And while I was there at the college for 8 years altogether and worked my way up to a position of a training consultant, you know, where I ran projects to diagnose new training needs for customs inspectors. I led the workshops to design the lesson plans and so on. And while I was doing all of that, I was working, you know, with experts from across the country and even experts from other countries who would come in to assist with the preparation of the training and the delivery of the training. And I was like a sponge, you know. It was an opportunity for me to really absorb all of the details, all the information. Plus, my wife was a customs inspector. She worked for customs for 25 years before she retired. And so, you know, I always had someone to ask when I went home at night, if I had a question about something I didn't quite understand, she could explain it to me. So.
Now, this is the third book in the series, the Donahue Stainer series. So we don't have to read the first two to read this one, right?
No, you can read any of the three. The order isn't important.
Yeah, but in terms of who Donahue and Stainer are, you can probably enlighten us before we start reading this book. as to who they are. I mean, they got personalities that are different?
Oh, very different, yes. Yeah, so the series is set in the fictional city of Glendale, Maryland, and Lieutenant Hank Donahue and Detective Karen Stainer are homicide investigators with the Glendale Police Department. And Hank Donahue comes from an upper-class background. His mother is a retired city prosecutor. His father was a criminal defense attorney and a law professor. So his maternal grandfather was state governor. His maternal great-grandfather was a chief justice of the state Supreme Court. And so his mother, in retirement, is still a prominent and influential Republican. So Hank Donahue is wealthy because of his family inheritance. And, of course, the series has to explore his reasons for becoming a street cop, you know, instead of something more suitable to his background.
Mm-hmm.
And Karen Stainer, on the other hand, is she's a born cop. She comes from Texas. Her father was a Texas state trooper. Her oldest brother is an Oklahoma state trooper. She's, you know, a born cop from a cop family. And so their backgrounds are quite different.
And so I guess Donahue's mom would have known H.J. Jarrett, right?
That's correct, yes. That's part of the focus of this novel, The Fregoli Delusion, is that investigating the murder of the fifth richest man in the state, he has to interview friends of his mother. And so there's always this inclination from his mother or her friends to kind of interfere with the investigation as it's ongoing in one way or another, since they're used to power and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, so I guess if their class could be, I mean, they're part of the 1%, I suppose, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and so it's timely because, I mean, we've been, you know, that word 1% or whatever that is, it's become, you know, it's become part of the vernacular, and we know automatically what that means. So I guess that's something that you explore in the book, is it?
It is, yes, to a certain extent, particularly from the angle of Stainer. Because for the first time in the series, now we're in the third novel, for the first time in this novel, there's friction between Donahue and Stainer, and that's at the root of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because Stainer tends to go into any interview or interrogation, you know, with a lot of foul language, with very direct statements and accusations to try to, you know, that kind of interview technique. And it doesn't go over very well with the one percenters. You know, they don't appreciate being talked to that way. And
mm-hmm.
So there's pressure being put on her to tone down or to let her partner that she's working with in this investigation take the lead in interviews with these people. And so she's getting more and more angry as the novel goes on. You know, like, am I not supposed to ask these people questions because they're rich? Is that what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. Now, the Fregoli delusion, I mean, that exists, right? That's a real thing?
It is, yes.
Yeah. Had you come across it many times, I guess, in the course of your research, or?
No, I hadn't, actually. It was one of those serendipitous things. I was doing research on Alzheimer's disease and memory loss, that kind of thing. Which is a theme that I touched on in the second book, Marcy's Murder, to a certain degree. And while I was doing that research, I came across something called delusional misidentification syndrome, where people have an inability to properly identify people, you know, linked to facial recognition
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing. And then I noticed these articles online to do with Fregoli delusion, took a look at it, and I thought, well, what a great premise for a novel where, you know, the key eyewitness suffers from this illness.
And so I guess the premise is that the person who has this psychotic disorder, he witnesses the murder of Jarrett, but because of this disorder, I guess his testimony is thrown out.
It won't be usable.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
They can't even take it into account in their investigation because the state's attorney won't even entertain the guy as a witness.
Yeah.
So they have to look elsewhere.
Has there been a case where this has happened? Say in a trial?
Not to my knowledge. No.
No.
It's a pretty rare condition. actually.
Yeah.
I exchanged some emails with a fellow named Dr. Ramin Motabi, who's he's an associate professor at Johns Hopkins University, mm-hmm. with their Bloomberg School of Public Health, I guess it is. And he's written a couple of articles on Fragolic delusion, which he shared with me, and he answered some of the questions I had about the condition. It's actually quite rare. And from him, I learned that when you look at Fragolic, you have to look at it in the context of existing conditions, like paranoid schizophrenia, for example.
I see.
With he was explaining to me that that's the most common instance. I think they only have, like, his articles only work with 35 to 45 documented cases.
Yeah.
So it's rare enough that they don't know everything about the syndrome yet.
Yeah.
And it's also rare enough that I can work with it in a fictional context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, that's fascinating to think about. Yeah, so this is something that we don't know about, that they don't know about, especially these experts.
Yeah.
And then you have to work on it in a novel of a sort. Donahue and Stainer, you must like them on a certain level, that you write these books about them.
I must like them as the author?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
And did you find that you had, say, an inspiration for one or the two or both in real life, say?
Not really, no. No, that's a tough question for me to answer because I don't know where these characters actually came from.
Really?
It's hard to... It's like Stainer in particular, because she jumps right out. After a couple of days, with each character, I write a backgrounder. Before I work with them in a story, I write a backgrounder so that I've got a basic understanding of who they are, you know, how old they are, what their background is, what their education is. With Stainer, she just, I don't know where the hang she came from, Joe, I really don't. She just leaped right off the page. And, I can just work with her with complete confidence. I can always find her voice when it's time for her to, you know, come on stage, basically.
Yeah.
She always rings true. I don't know. I can't explain it.
Yeah. So do you know how long the series will run? I mean, do you have a number, say, of how many books you want to do with these characters in them?
When I was beginning, I did an overall series arc, and I mapped out about five. But I keep getting new ideas, you know, that I'm going to be slotting into that. So basically, I'm just going to keep going until they carry me out on a plank, I guess.
Yeah. And you've developed quite a following, haven't you? I mean, a lot of people read your books, do they?
It's starting to come. Yes, that's right. Yeah, I get fan emails, which is really cool.
Really? Yeah. Now, do you have an idea of who reads you, say, well, what demographic, or is it mainly Canadians? Is it mainly Americans, or?
Well, I've got a mix. I've got readers in the UK. I have a lot of readers in the United States, of course, and I've got a pretty good following in Canada. As far as the demographic goes, I think it's been fairly well proven through studies that Sisters in Crime did in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That the people who read mystery stories in general are basically women, you know, from the age of about 25 to 50, I suppose. So overwhelmingly, it's women that I'm getting the feedback from.
Did you spend much time in Maryland? I mean, I'm curious to know why you set the book there, the books there, I should say.
No, actually, I haven't spent time in Maryland, except virtually. I spent a whole lot of time there.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of research on the state. I chose Maryland in more or less at random. I wanted a state that was on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And I was interested in Maryland because actually what piqued my interest in the state was when I was reading the book Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was talking about Maryland and the precarious position it had during the Second World War, and, you know, being under martial law, the sort of that divided mentality that it had, that stuck in my head, and it's kept my interest. And so working with Maryland now in a fictional series, I like the fact that it has a divided self-image, that you can find pockets that say that Maryland is a northern state. You can find other pockets that say it's a southern state.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing they agree on is that nobody likes the term Mid-Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's too wishy-washy for everyone. So So it's a fascinating state. I really enjoy it.
Now, you dedicate this book to your mother.
Yeah.
Did she like stories of this sort?
No, actually. She was never really a reader at all, except for Harlequin romances. When I was an undergrad, I used to read all her Harlequin romances. That was another genre that I picked up and read just to see how they worked as fiction.
Yeah.
But no, she never really read mysteries at all.
Yeah. But she's, of course, an influence in your life, right?
Very much so. And this book of the three was the hardest to get finished and get out the door, primarily because of my mom and her condition. The first two I wrote while she was still at home on her own. But for Goalie, while I was writing this, she developed Alzheimer's disease, moved into the middle stages, and required, constant daily care. So I had moved her down from my hometown so that she was close to me.
Yeah.
And so there, I was as her primary caregiver. It took a lot of my time, which I was very glad to give, of course, because I've always been close to her. But also the stress level was incredible.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with someone who has Alzheimer's, it tears you apart, really. And so this book was really, really hard to get finished. It was hard for me to come back to the keyboard and slip back into that mental state, when you're doing creative writing. And so once I finally got it finished and I got her in a place where she was being, she's now in a situation where she's being looked after very well and all of that, I thought, it's done. She's okay. This is her book.
Mm-hmm. Now, what also interested me about you in preparing for our chat today was how you got these books published. The first book, how long after you wrote it did it get published?
It took, I would say, about 2 years to get it published, because my first intention, of course, was to have the series published by a traditional publishing house. I always dreamed of being,
right,
in a Dell paperback or something,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. like all my heroes in crime fiction. But that wasn't going to happen, because the industry has changed. And, of course, publishing companies, they don't take over the transom submissions anymore. They all have to be agented submissions. So I took almost 2 years trying to find an agent who would represent me and represent the books. And that's even more difficult anymore than trying to find even a small publisher to publish a novel. So at the end of 2 years, it was at Christmas 2010, and I kind of made a decision between Christmas and New Year's that I would give myself until April 1st, 2011, April Fool's Day. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have an agent by April the 1st, then I would publish the book myself, and I would just go forward as an independent. And I took that time between Christmas and April 1st, 2011, to research how that worked. I looked at people who were successful at self-publishing, the Amanda Hawkings and John Locke's and mm-hmm. all those people. I looked at the models that they were using to publish their own stuff, and I took things that I thought might work for me. And then, when April 1st came around, I got up and I was in the shower, and I said, okay, it's April Fool's Day, Mike. You don't have an agent? Which is it going to be? Are you going to just do something else, or are you going to go ahead and publish this and keep writing them? So I formed my own company, the Plaid Raccoon Press,
mm-hmm.
and published Blood Passage that way.
Yeah, and so the model's working for you, isn't it?
It is, yes. It's slow. It takes a long time to build a foundation as an independent, a really long time, and it takes an awful lot of work, but it's coming. I'm starting to gain traction, and that's really, really gratifying.
Yeah, and so this series will obviously continue, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And so how long till the next one?
Well, I'm starting the research on it right now. I would like to be able to publish it next June.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see, you know, what life has to say about that. But that's my objective anyway. I hope to be, in about 3 weeks, I'd like to start writing the first draft.
Yeah, and so in terms of the research that one does, is that does that involve travel, say?
Not generally, no. But I'm the kind of guy that they designed Google for.
Yeah.
It's amazing the amount of good, solid information I have been able to get over the Internet. So I don't really have much of a budget for travel right now because it has to come out of the raccoon's pocket.
Yeah.
And so I try to do everything from here as much as I can anyway.
Yeah, I had a guy in, I can't remember his name now, it escapes me. He wrote a novel, and it was like a best-selling novel. And he said that he never went to the place, because he didn't have to, because he had Google Street View.
That's right.
Yeah, and he could just get into, I guess, the culture even.
Oh, yeah,
through that.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable what you can do in this day and age.
Yeah. Well, Mike, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. I'm looking forward to finishing the book.
Oh, that's great. I really enjoyed it, Joe. Thanks very much for having me. It's been great fun.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Fregoli Delusion. It's published by Plaid Raccoon Press. You can get the information on how to buy the book, download it, etc., from Michael's website, mjmccann.com. Michael J. McCann on the line from Oxford Station, Ontario in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.